Okay, so we all know one peculiar velocity very well, which is the motion of our local group with respect to the cosmic microwave background because of this nice dipole that we see in the sky. All right, so we've known for quite a long time, since the mid-70s, that we're moving at about 600 kilometers per second with respect to this background. But the question, which is still, I'll argue, unanswered, is where does this motion come from? Okay, we think it's due to fluctuations which grow through gravitational instability. But where are those fluctuations? Are they nearby or are they on large scales? Okay, so this question, what is the source of this motion, can be translated into answering the question, on what scale is the universe at rest, or on what scale do we have a fair sample of the universe? Okay, so the important thing about peculiar velocities, which are deviations from the uniform expansion, is that unlike measures of, say, the clustering of galaxies, which probe the fluctuations in the light, the peculiar velocities respond to fluctuations in the mass. Okay, and they're really the only way to measure directly the large-scale fluctuations in the mass density. And as we'll see later, you can probe very, very large scales that you can't currently access with any other technique. All right. So let me talk about not just the peculiar motion of our own local group of galaxies, but rather the peculiar velocity field. Can we extend these measurements from beyond our local group to other galaxies? There are several ways to do this. Before I do that, I'll give you a little bit of theory. Okay. So in the standard picture, we know that in the linear regime where the fluctuations are small, the peculiar velocity is proportional to the peculiar acceleration. Okay, so in other words, if I have a fluctuation delta in the mass density, where that delta is just density minus mean density normalized by mean density, okay, then that fluctuation field delta will generate a peculiar acceleration. Okay, so overdense regions attract, and regions that are underdense compared to the average repel. And that peculiar acceleration is proportional to the peculiar velocity. Okay, and there's some extra factors which come out in front, and an important one which we'll come back to later is this f of omega. Okay, so f here is the logarithmic derivative of the growth rate of fluctuations as a function of expansion factor A. Okay, and for most cosmologies, standard cosmologies that we talk about, this turns out to be a simple function of omega matter. Okay, so for a flat lambda CDM model, for example, this exponent here is 0.55. Different modified gravity models, it might be different, or it may not even be expressed by this simple function. Okay, but for most of the talk, I'm going to assume this is true. And then we'll come back and talk a little bit about how you can test this at the end. So in other words, the peculiar velocity is sensitive to two things, essentially an omega matter dependence here and the fluctuations in the mass density. Okay, and so there's a little bit of a degeneracy there. If we don't know precisely what omega matter is and we don't know precisely what the amplitude of the fluctuations are, there'll be some degeneracy between those two parameters. But that's not necessarily a bad thing, as I'll show later. Okay, so this is the basic framework. And the nice thing about this is that you can use your intuition from first year physics about how attractors attract things and so on to figure out what a peculiar velocity field might look like. So there are different ways to measure them. Okay, so we saw one already, which is the dipole in the CMB. That we can only do for our own system. For other galaxies, there's at least three different ways to measure these, and I'm going to talk mostly about the first of these. Okay, this is the most straightforward way. The peculiar velocity is just the deviation from the Hubble expansion. So the total expansion velocity, at least at low z's, is just cz. Okay, so if we subtract off what we would have got for a given galaxy's distance according to the Hubble law, then the difference between the two is the peculiar velocity. Straightforward. So this thing is easy to measure from spectra. This is a lot harder, okay, because getting the R's is difficult. You need some kind of standard candle or standard ruler to measure that. And none of those are particularly accurate. There's another method, which is you may have heard a little bit about the kinetic Sinyavzeldovich effect. Okay, so the Sinyavzeldovich effect occurs when you have a cloud of hot electrons, for example, a cluster of galaxies, which is scattering up the CMB photons. Okay, and the kinetic version of this effect occurs because that cluster, for example, may be itself moving with respect to the CMB. Okay, so that causes a change in the background temperature from what you would have observed if the cluster hadn't been there. And in principle, you can use this effect to measure the peculiar velocity of that object which is doing the scattering. The problem with this method is that we don't know what the true temperature is behind the object because of the because of the intrinsic fluctuations in the CMB itself. Okay, so the CMB acts like a source of noise for this measurement. Nevertheless, there was a recent result by a group led by Kashlinsky that claimed that when they studied a sample of clusters extending out to a redshift of about 0.3, that entire sample was moving with respect to the CMB at a relatively high velocity, something of order 600 to 1,000 kilometers per second, something which you wouldn't expect in the standard model of cosmology. Okay, and they dubbed that effect the dark flow, because everything has to be dark. All right, I'll come back to talk about that a little bit later. The last way that you can do this is not on a point-by-point basis, but you can do it statistically via redshift space distortions. So if you have a set of measurements of galaxies in position on the sky and redshift, the redshift, of course, is not exactly given by Hubble's expansion because of the peculiar velocities. So if you look at the structure in redshift space, in other words, in this funny 3D space, if you imagine a wave going outwards along the line of sight, that wave will tend to be compressed because things are falling in towards the peaks, okay, and out of the voids. Whereas a similar wave that is whose wave vector is tangential to the line of sight, you won't see this effect. So you'll see an enhancement of clustering along the line of sight compared to perpendicular. All right, you measure the power spectrum of the fluctuations in both directions and take the ratios, you can figure out what the average rate of peculiar velocities is. So I'll talk about that a little bit right at the very end. Okay. Mostly I'm going to talk about this method here. Okay, this is the most direct way. All right, so what we want to do in the first instance is start to map out our own this field of peculiar velocities around expanding around our local group. Okay, we already know what it is for the local group in 600 kilometers per second with respect to the CMB frame. The problem is, if you want to think about this in a cartoon way, in a pictorial way, the peculiar velocity, let's imagine that there's just one attractor in the universe, one overdense region. That's a simplification because we know that we live in a Gaussian random field, but it's good for visualizing the cartoon. Okay, so that if we had only one mass concentration in the nearby universe, all right, if we go back to this equation here, so we've only got one mass, a delta function at one position, there's a degeneracy from one measurement between a small fluctuation that's nearby or a larger one at larger distances. Okay, so to really map out the structure of fluctuations on different scales, we want to get not only one measurement of V, but a whole range of them. And that's more or less what this says. Excuse me. So a lot of the history of this field has been about trying to just make these maps and figure out where the dominant sources of this 600 kilometers per second motion are. Are they due to relatively nearby structures? Those of you who are older may remember something called the Great Attractor, which by today's standards is a relatively local source. On the other hand, people talk about coherent bulk flows, which you can think about as sort of a relatively smooth flow, suggesting an attractor at a larger distance. Okay. So just by empirically mapping this, we can figure out where the fluctuations are on different scales. So here's the cartoon version of this. You know, here we are, the local group moving off in some direction, okay, which we already know the amplitude of this vector. And we want to know, are we falling into something that's relatively nearby, okay? Or is there an attractor much, much farther away? And over the scale of this box, these arrows would look more or less coherent. There'd be a slight tidal field across it. Okay, so imagine this box is the scale of what we can actually measure. Okay, this is a simplification, as I said, because we know that we'd live in a Gaussian random field without these single attractors, but that's the basic idea. So here's a, doesn't show up too well. Here's a more realistic view of what the actual peculiar velocity field might look like. Okay, so what, it's gotten a little bit wiped out here. I'll tell you what this is. So this is a survey of galaxies, okay? And we're gonna assume that in this map that mass and light are proportional to each other. I'll come back to that later. If we have a map of the galaxy density field smoothed on some scale, okay, we can plug that in to the previous formula and predict the peculiar velocities everywhere. Okay, so and then what's shown here is a slice through a three-dimensional sphere. Okay, in a plane which contains most of the important structures, a supergalactic plane. So we live here at 0, 0, okay, and our 600 kilometers per second motion is over here. For those of you who know your cosmography, the Virgo cluster would be up here, Coma is up here. This big lump is something that used to get called the Great Attractor. Okay, this just gives you a feeling that, of course, is not a simple single attractor model. There's overdense regions in different places, and there's also underdense regions. And if you could see the arrows a little bit better, you'd see that those underdense regions give a push. Okay, so the true picture is going to be more complicated. So given a set of measurements of peculiar velocities, I said that measuring the distances is difficult. They're very noisy. So a given distance measurement is only good to maybe 10 or 20%, depending on what the distance estimator is. Okay, and if you have an object which is, say, at a distance of 100 h inverse megaparsecs, that would be a Hubble recession velocity of 10,000 kilometers per second. 20% is 2,000 kilometers per second. All right, so the individual measurement error is quite large on a point-by-point basis. All right, so one thing you can do with many measurements is beat it down by root n. And the simplest statistic that you can measure, or one of the simplest things that you can think of measuring, is just an average, okay, of all the individual peculiar velocities. Okay, and that's what we call the bulk flow. And the advantage of the bulk flow is that it's sensitive to structures which are beyond the scale over which you're averaging. Okay, so the bulk flow turns out to be a very powerful probe of the very, very largest scales. Okay. Yes?
So how do you know this error going correlated from galaxy to galaxy?
We don't think that there's any evidence, both empirical or physical, that we would think that they would be correlated from very distant galaxies in different places. We've never seen any evidence that they're correlated. Because then the nature of the scatter is something like, let's say you take supernovae, for example. So we don't understand the physics of supernovae. So provided there's no modulation in the basic laws of physics around the universe, then a supernova over here shouldn't know anything about what's happening with the supernovae hundreds of millions of light years ago. They've never been in contact with each other. They can live in overdense and underdense, but we're all talking about much, much bigger scales where there's overdense and underdense regions everywhere, and we're averaging out over all of those. Right. So people have looked at systematics as a function of overdensity, and nobody's ever found any compelling evidence for them. If they're there, they're at a very low level. So we can make a measurement, to come back to this idea of the bulk flow, around the origin, the local group, and that's fine, but we want to compare it with models. And that measurement is a measurement at only one location in the universe, and at present it's the only place that we can make this measurement. Okay, so if we measure an average velocity for, not say for our local group, but say for some sphere that goes out to a certain number of megaparsecs, 50 megaparsecs, we'd like to know how typical that velocity is. And the cosmology will tell us what the cosmic variance is, the variation from point to point, is in that number. Okay, so for this audience, you know all this stuff already, but let me just remind you, you can imagine doing the thought experiment of going around the universe and measuring the average velocity within spheres at different places. Okay, And of course, there's no preferred direction in the universe as far as we know, so the mean of those should be zero. All right, but the standard deviation, of course, is non-zero, and that's the cosmic variance. And the important point is that that standard deviation depends on the power spectrum of fluctuations, and it depends on how big a sphere, the shape of your window, if you like, that you're measuring. Okay, so here's the graphical version of this. So go back to this picture. Now imagine very small spheres, all right? You know, so here's one, it's fairly low. Okay, here's another one. The mean velocity in there is very low, if you can see the arrows. In this one, it's a bit higher, okay, because there's an object right there. Okay, so we can imagine doing this with many spheres, whoops, and going around and taking the variance of it. Now I've gotten out of whack. All right. So we're going to do the same calculation, but we're going to talk now about spheres that are about this big, about as big as what you see pictured here, and we imagine that they're structures on larger scales. Okay. But we only have one measurement, all right? So how do we calculate that variance? So this has all been worked out before many years ago, particularly by Nick Kaiser in the late 80s. If we know the power spectrum of density fluctuations, okay, we can relate that to the RMS velocities. Here's our omega to the 0.55 factor squared, okay? And this will depend on the power spectrum of fluctuations and a window function in Fourier space, which is the Fourier transform of our survey geometry. Okay. Now, a nice window to have would be something that's fairly smooth, like a Gaussian. Okay. So just to give you a feeling of the order of magnitude, if you had a Gaussian window whose radius was 50 H inverse megaparsecs in the lambda CDM model, you would expect that the sigma V is around 100 kilometers per second. Okay, and there's three components. It's an RMS of 100 in each direction. All right, so typical velocity would be 150 or 170 or something like that. It's root 3 times that. Yeah?
How much does this depend on the chance of wind function?
So,
if you use a heavy side box?
Yeah, so if you use a heavy side box, for example, and that depends on what you want to do. A heavy side box is actually not a good choice if your goal is to understand the fluctuations on a very large scale, because the box, when it Fourier transforms, will ring, and it will pick up contributions from higher k, smaller scale modes that will be mixed in with the large scale modes. Okay. So I'm going to skip a lot of the technical work that we did with some collaborators. I'll mention a little bit later. Some of it, which is really how you optimize this window, okay? And I'll just tell you that we've taken our data and we've made it look like a Gaussian, all right? And so this gives you a feeling of what this actually looks like, okay? So this is log of wave number, okay? And this is some arbitrary vertical scale. So the window function that we've constructed is this black line here. Okay. The power spectrum is here. Okay. And when you put them all together, you get the thing that's in the denominator. In the lower panel, which shows you the multiplication of the window function and the power spectrum. And there's some correction for, because this is a logarithmic scale in K. And what it shows you is that most of this variance, okay, is coming from scales around 0.01. And that's a very big scale, okay? That's a wavelength of 600 megaparsecs. So this scale is bigger than what you can currently achieve with Sloan, for example, right now, or any survey that has been published, including the Wiggle Z survey in Australia. However, I think the BOSS surveys, which are currently being done, will reach these scales in galaxies, but not in mass. Okay, so that's the important point here, is these very large scales. You get the secondary bump here. Now, when people worry about nonlinear effects in the power spectrum, those nonlinear effects are down here, okay, below 0.01, 0.02. So this is a purely linear measurement.
Sir?
Yeah?
You took Gaussian in the function?
Yeah.
You took Gaussian?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a Gaussian in this
case.
Yeah, there's a funny ringing effect because you only see the components along the line of sight. That's what gives you this multiplication. Yeah.
So
If you could measure 3D components, then it would look Gaussian.
If you use some digital sky survey data, it only goes to a depth redshift by 1, which is not that far into the universe.
So are you talking about measuring the galaxy power spectrum? So those, the largest scales of those probe don't reach these, and I'll show you a comparison in a few minutes. Okay. So I've already said a little bit about this. Measuring the peculiar velocities. As I said, measuring the redshifts is easy. Measuring the R is harder. Different methods give you either a 20 or a 10% uncertainty. Okay, that's the thing to bear in mind, that this is noisy. Okay. Supernovae are a little bit better than Tully-Fisher fundamental plane, but they're not perfect. I think I am going to skip this discussion of sparse sampling because it's not critical for this talk. It's just to point out that one of the issues with this, with the analysis of the data, is that the surveys don't fill this volume uniformly. Okay. So here's one particular survey overlaid on that plane that I showed you. The red things are moving away from us. The blue things are moving towards us. Okay. A different survey, and remember each of these have 10 or 20% error bars on them, samples a different region of space. So lots of the confusion in this field in the past has been how do you relate this to this? Oops, sorry. It seemed to go the right way. To this, when they're sampling different regions. And so with collaborators Feldman and Watkins, we put a lot of effort into trying to find a scheme. Essentially, it's a weighting scheme, which tries to do two things. It tries to make each survey measurements of the mean velocity as compatible with other ones as possible. Okay. And the second thing is it tries to make each survey match some given idealized survey. And the way we did it for the aficionados, if you want to know in words what we do, is for each point in space, we are free to, when calculating a mean, we don't have to just take a straight mean. We can calculate a weighted mean if we like. Okay, and we have the freedom to adjust those weights any way we like. Okay, so the weights are adjusted in such a way that for a given power spectrum, the difference between the weighted mean and the velocity of some idealized survey will be as small as possible. Okay, and that depends only on the spatial positions at which the velocities are measured and doesn't know anything about the actual velocities. Okay, so we did a lot of work on this, but I'm gonna go over it fairly quickly. It's described in these two papers here. Most of it's in the first one here. Okay, so this just shows you this. I mean, with the projector, there's a curve here which has completely disappeared. it's not shown at all. The important thing is that once we've weighted our data, let's just look at the solid curve and the smooth one. Once we've weighted our data, we have a reasonable match to some ideal window. And we know exactly by how much that non-ideal thing differs from the ideal. And we can take that into account in the analysis. Okay. So one of the things we find when we do this, when we analyzed all these different surveys which have been done before, some of which seem to disagree, is that once we apply our optimal weighting scheme and we really compare them as fairly as we can, we find that actually all the previous peculiar velocity surveys which have been done using these different methods, supernovae, fundamental plane, Tully-Fisher, actually agree with each other. And the apparent disagreement, which I didn't go into in detail, had to do with not accounting for this different geometry. Okay, there is one exception to this, and the aficionados can ask me about that later on if they're interested. So here's two compilations of different peculiar velocity surveys. Okay, so there's one which we creatively call DEEP, and it's a set of peculiar velocities measured in clusters, okay, from about 5 different groups, okay, some using fundamental plane, some using Tully-Fisher, some using supernovae. Okay? We put all of those together and we apply this optimal weighting scheme to them. We find that together this whole sample has a flow of about 400 kilometers, just under 400 kilometers per second in a certain direction. Another sample that was released very recently, a couple of years ago, is this so-called SFI++ sample. This is based on the Tully-Fisher method for measuring distances. Okay, and it's a very large sample. And if we analyze that one, which is independent of this one, we also get a bulk flow, now a little bit more than 400 kilometers per second, in a direction, these are galactic coordinates, that are similar to these two. Okay, so this is circa 2009. We found that these two subsamples of all the peculiar velocity data seem to agree with each other. Okay, and so when we put them together, we put the two together, we found that the sum of these, or the union of them, had a velocity of about 400 kilometers per second. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah, we can only measure the radial component. That's right.
Or you reconstruct also the.
No, we don't reconstruct it, but we have radial here and radial there, okay, and radial there and radial there. So we have a sort of a pseudo 3D field, if you like. And from that, you can calculate an average velocity.
Is there a way of getting an error on the directions? Or is that
yeah, there is. I just haven't listed it here. It's about 10 degrees or so.
So they're consistent.
Yeah, they're consistent. They're fully consistent with direction.
If there were a rotation.
If there were a rotation around us, we wouldn't see it. We wouldn't see it. Now, we don't expect any rotation in a standard picture because the rotational mode at early times decays away. And if the typical velocities and structure are what they are in the CMB, then and even if that CMB contains some rotational modes, they will be gone by now. Okay. Yeah?
In your reference map, you had to reconstruct it. Particular velocity.
We didn't reconstruct anything. We just took a weighted mean. Okay. So we have measurements of the radial component of the peculiar velocity, all right, in different directions on the sky. And of that, we construct a weighted mean of that quantity. Okay. And the fact that we get a bulk flow says that the ones on this side of the sky are going out, and the ones on this side are coming in.
But I mean, if you have a structure far from you, and then you measure just the radial velocity, you will find nothing here. There is a bulk velocity, for example, in this direction.
Right. So if we have a structure that's centered around us, if we were in the center of a structure or in the center of a void, for example, then we would get a term which would be degenerate with the Hubble parameter. Okay, the Hubble constant that we would measure locally would be confused with this effect. Okay, but any off-centered structure that's not spherically symmetric around us will give us this motion. Just think of that cartoon that I showed you right at the beginning. Right? So this was surprising because, as I said, in Lambda CDM, we expect this to be about 100 kilometers or so in each direction. Okay, so it's a deviation from what you expect from Lambda CDM. Okay, and at the time that this came out in 2009, it was discrepant at about the 2.5 sigma level. Okay, in other words, from cosmic variance alone, it's possible that we could live in a Lambda CDM universe, and we just happen to live in a special location where the average velocity is high. Okay, but the probability of that is an order of a percent or two. Okay, so subsequent to this, we've analyzed some new data, and this just came out a little while ago. This is done with my one of my students, Stephen Turnbull. So there's some new supernova peculiar velocities, about 250 of them, okay? And they have a velocity, I haven't printed the direction here. The direction is a little bit different, but not wildly inconsistent with what we found before. But the amplitude is a bit lower, okay? It's about 250 kilometers per second. Again, matched to this idealized Gaussian window, okay? So this measurement by itself, this set, if you like, is consistent with Lambda CDM. Okay, it's completely consistent. As I said, you get about 100 and something in each direction. Okay, so for 3D, you expect just under 200, maybe. But with the distribution, right? It's a Maxwellian distribution. So the odds of getting 250 are not unusual. the odds of getting 400 are unusual. Okay, so the stuff that we haven't published here is, oops, oh, sorry. So that, we got it, at least we got it. We didn't get in the New York Times, but we did get in Wired. because it was in conflict with this dark flow measurement that I mentioned earlier, and I'll come back to. Okay, and so that was fairly recent, right? Just last month.
So Mike, is it obvious it's in conflict because these are different scales, right?
So, okay, can you ask me that later? So the stuff which wasn't in that paper is that everybody's and is waiting for another paper is, well, what happens if you put all these data sets, let's assume they're all correct, and put them all together, okay? So we can apply the same thing by adding this older data set, which we called composite, to this new data set of supernovae, and we find that those two data sets are consistent with each other given their sampling, given their random errors, okay? So the 250 is not in conflict with the 400. Okay, so if we pile them all together, then we get a total velocity of about 340, okay, in a similar direction to what we found before. And this, of course, is less inconsistent with lambda CDM, but it's still at the borderline.
Can you check what you mean by consistency? There are some lambdas.
Yeah, so I mean, here's the...
In the first book, you said you got 400 and then you got 250.
Yeah. So when you account for the fact that let's go back past the flashing. Okay, so here we've got 400 plus or minus roughly 80. Okay, and here we've got 250 plus or minus 75. The error in the difference is of order of 100. Right, so they're about 1.5 sigma apart. It doesn't show you the direction here, which is also slightly different. When you do the whole analysis properly, they're consistent with each other at less than somewhere at like 1.5 sigma or something. Yeah.
You're selecting different options.
Yes.
So you have a selection for your.
Yes.
You use LRGs.
Yeah, so, so these are the very nearby objects, and we're using the peculiar velocities. When you're thinking of the SDSS stuff, you're using the galaxies to trace the large scale structures. So it's a very different measurement. Okay,
maybe
but
that has an effect. So
we don't.
Well,
they're different quantities, right? They're different. One is a velocity, and one is a clustering measurement. Okay, so they're very different. I'll show you. You can convert them both into a power spectrum, which I'll show you in a bit. Okay. So let's go past here. So the bottom line at this stage, the bottom line here is that the consistency with lambda CDM is around 2 sigma. Okay. So you might not worry about it too much, depending on your point of view, or you might want to worry about it a lot. Maybe it's the hint something exciting happened, or maybe it's just a fluctuation. I don't know the answer to that. So this is, I've already sort of described this in a little bit more detail. This is a plot from our older sample, the composite sample, just showing what you get vary the parameters of a lambda CDM spectrum and you want to match the previous 400 kilometers per second flow. Okay, so this is the quantity sigma 8, the fluctuations in 8 megaparsec sphere. Here's omega matter times h squared, and I'm sorry this isn't reproducing very well. The important point here is that different regions of parameter space are excluded by bulk flow. So bulk flows would like you to be up here, okay, with a high value of sigma 8. High normalization to the fluctuations, and a low value of omega matter because of the shape of the power spectrum. If you're normalizing on 8 megaparsecs, that lower omega matter means more power on large scale. It's a bit paradoxical. Okay? The WMAP at this time, the time we wrote this paper, WMAP 5 data were here. Okay? So they differed from that by roughly the 99% level. Okay, now with the supernovae data, these contours have shifted a little bit down this way. The disagreement's not as bad. Okay, so that was the older 98% number. You can do more than just measure the mean velocity, the bulk flow. You can say, well, let's extend this to higher order moments. Okay, so we can measure a shear, for example. It's expanded in multipoles. It gets very noisy because once you get too many multipoles, you start having as many as you have data points, and each one of those has very large errors. Okay, so we could get about as up to the octopole. The octopole didn't tell us very much. The shear was interesting. Okay, and when you do this analysis with the higher order moments, you find it's nice because the dipole, you know, I showed you the window function for that before, really probes the very largest scales. The shear measures somewhat smaller scales, and the octopole smaller scales, and so on. Okay, and what we found when we did this analysis, which is in Feldman et al., is it's really the only the dipole which is anomalously high. The shear is what you expect, or low even. Okay, and so there's nothing. If there is anything funny happening with lambda CDM, it's only the evidence from the peculiar velocities is only on the very larger scales. Okay, that's the takeaway message. The other takeaway message from this work is that if you imagine a single attractor model, okay, the shear will fall off as 1 over r cubed of your distance away from that. Okay, tidal, it's like a tidal effect, right? And so if you measure a high velocity with a low shear, that implies it's a big thing that's far away instead of a small thing that's nearby. Okay, so if it was a single attractor, you can take ratios of the shear and the dipole or bulk flow and try to estimate the distance. And so that argument suggests that if there are, you know, if there are real structures out there causing this, then they're on scales that are bigger than 300 megaparsecs in distance. Okay. So you can put all that together and try to actually create, measure a power spectrum from this measurement. Okay. Again, this is the older data set that we call composite, the first two that I added together. And so the gray bars are actually what you measure, converting those three moments that I described into band powers. This is in Macaulay et al. So as I said, the dipole really measures the largest scales below about or around or below k of 10 to the minus 2, 0.01. Okay, so that's sort of shown schematically here by this gray box, okay, which, because the dipole is high, lies above what you would predict from lambda CDM. Okay, the shear and the octopole really have enormous error bars. These are sort of like 1 sigma error bars. I guess the mean is down here. So they don't give you much useful information on the power spectrum. Okay, and the plots that are overlaid on top of them are, let's see, again, the little triangles have been wiped out. There's one that you can maybe see, another one there, and there's some more down here. That's 2DF, okay? And the dots are Sloan, okay? And so on nonlinear scales, they differ a little bit. They kind of agree with each other, and they agree with lambda CDM. And, you know, maybe there's something a little bit discrepant there. It's hard to say. So the last measured point that you get in Sloan from galaxy fluctuations, okay, is sort of on the same, just touching the same scales that we measure with large scale flows. Okay, so explanations, systematic errors in the peculiar velocities. We don't think that there's any significant systematic errors. Different surveys, which are done by very independent methods, seem to be consistent with each other. So that seems less likely. A possibility is that lambda CDM is correct, and we just happen to live in a slightly unusual place, okay, which is, you know, 2.5%, 2 sigma. Okay, it's not very Copernican to live in a special place. Depends if this bothers you or not. Okay. Third possibility is that, you know, it's not that we live in a special place, but maybe the power spectrum is different from what lambda CDM predicts. Okay, and of course there's more exotic explanations that are possible. Right? Maybe the whole picture is not correct. Okay. So let me talk a little bit. How am I doing for time? I don't have my presenter, so I'm 15. All right, I better go a little bit faster then. So kinetic Sinyavzeldovich effect I mentioned already, okay? And I'll go through this a little bit faster. I'll just give you a little bit of the history of this. Kishlinski et al. Measured the KSZ effect from clusters out to redshift of 0.3. Okay, so to get, I've always talked in H inverse megaparsecs for our stuff, but it goes out to 100 H inverse megaparsecs. That's like 0.03. Okay, so this is 10 times bigger in scale, right? And their claim was that this whole volume was moving at this high velocity. The intriguing thing about this from our perspective is that the direction of the flow that they found was actually quite closely aligned with ours, and the methods are very independent. Okay. Subsequent to that, other groups have challenged this result. Kiesler et al. 09, Osborne et al. 10, and they basically claim that this is not a 2.5 sigma measurement, which is what Kishlinski claimed, but rather a 0.5 sigma non-measurement. In other words, they've underestimated their error bars. And I think that's almost certainly true from work that Nyesh and I are doing with another postdoc, Guillaume Laveau, who's here part-time at Perimeter. We also find much larger uncertainties on this than what Kishlinski claimed. So I don't know what to believe about this. What other probes are there of very large-scale power? We've already mentioned some of them, okay? So we mentioned this, the galaxy power spectrum. The other one is the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, okay? So the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, quick primer for those who don't know, the CMB photons are coming towards us. They're going through a potential. If that potential is evolving in time, then they'll get a different blue shift and red shift as they pass through it. Okay, so it's a measure of the growth of fluctuations, and you can only do it on very, very large scales. So that's, I really wish the quality of this was a bit better, because you can't read the numbers here. So one paper here by Ho et al. Okay, measured the amplitude of the Sachs-Wolfe effect compared to what you expect in lambda CDM. That's what this A parameter is. So A should be 1. They measure A is 2.23 plus or minus 0.06. So they don't make a big deal of this. It's a 2 sigma higher than what you would expect from lambda CDM. But a different group find no particular excess. So I think this is a hard measurement to make, and I don't know where it stands right now. The galaxy power spectra we've already looked at. It's a little bit intriguing that on very large scales, Sloan and 2DF agree, and maybe they lie above the lambda CDM predictions. Okay. The caveat with all this is, of course, the largest scales are the most hard to measure. They're the most prone to systematic effects, very subtle systematics, which are at a low level in amplitude, can affect these things, right? Yes, for photometry, for example, star galaxy separation, et cetera. Yep?
The problem is that a small K, you don't have enough depth. Is it going to redshift at 1? That's why the data is so sparse.
They have enough. I mean, the error bars are cosmic variance dominated, right? But I think the real problem with the error bars that aren't plotted here are what are the systematics on those scales? Those are hard to measure, right? I mean, these are 600 megaparsec waves, but they're going to quite a large volume, right? They get a few of those waves within that volume. Large-scale voids have been proposed as a way of getting out of the dark energy problem. The postulate, and John Moffat was one of the people who've done this, proposing that we live in an underdense region, okay? And so to explain the supernovae results, you need these voids to be very big. The problem with such big, deep, underdense voids is almost the opposite. If we are not lying in the center of such a void, we actually get bulk flows that are too big. Okay? So to avoid over-predicting even our motion of the local group with respect to the CMB, we have to live something like 50 megaparsec towards the center of a void which is sort of gigaparsec scales.
There's been a recent paper from Oxford. If you don't assume a simultaneous big bang and avoid cosmology, which you don't should do, then you do fit the data.
I'm sure there's ways out. Okay, but from the simplest picture, to me, this seems even less Copernican than the CDM problem. Okay, so those are two ways out of it. The third way out, and I'll use this maybe in the last 10 minutes or so, about right, is that maybe it's not the power spectrum that's wrong. Maybe it's that F factor in front, okay, the growth rate F, which appears. And so it's been suggested that you could modify gravity. Okay, here are some authors, one of whom is in the room. The other ones have strong perimeter connections. They've suggested that this is another way out of it. If you change the F, right, then you might get agreement with it. And there's other reasons, presumably, to do that. So let's see what the data can tell us about this F function. Okay, oops. I will skip back because it's getting wiped out a little bit. It's supposed to show you, if you could see this side of the plot, that this is a map of the mass, and this is the map that I showed you before of the light. Okay, and it's supposed to show you that there's some rough correspondence between them, that at some level mass and light trace each other, even though the smoothing is different and this is very noisy, but the big structures you see in more or less the same places. Okay, and so the game that we're going to play is we're going to use these maps to predict the peculiar velocities and vice versa. Okay, and so the assumption is that the fluctuations in the galaxies are related to the fluctuations in the mass. Okay, so now I've dropped the subscript m for mass, where these fluctuations we've already defined. The simplest case, which is probably valid if you just Taylor expand this, where the fluctuations are small, is that the fluctuations in galaxies are proportional by some mysterious biasing parameter, and they're related to the fluctuations in the mass. Okay. So the advantage of that is if we have an actual map of the galaxies, delta galaxy now, not delta mass, okay, we can use this, and it goes out to some depth, R max, we can use this to actually predict these peculiar velocities. Okay, the price that we've paid in addition to this F is we've absorbed another factor of B here, which is another unknown. Okay, so this combination here gets called beta in the business. Okay. And so a map of the galaxies can be used to predict, and then we can compare one-on-one the actual observed measurements point by point, which is a different method than, say, just taking averages, which we were doing before. Okay, so now we're making the assumption that light and mass are related to each other. Okay?
What was U?
Sorry? The U is if your map of galaxies only goes out to some distance, you might want to model the contributions from beyond that distance as a dipole, and you can even imagine adding quadrupole and higher order terms for those exterior masses. Okay. So if we have data here, and this is one free degenerate parameter and this is another, we can fit the predictions with these two free parameters and get a value for each of these. Okay. And indeed, we can compare the U that we measure here with the previous bulk flows, but that's not something I'm going to talk about right here because I don't have time. You want to turn those numbers into cosmological parameters. Here's a little game you can play. Okay, if we assume that the galaxies are related to the mass by linear biasing, then the fluctuations, the RMS fluctuations, are related to the RMS fluctuations in mass, okay, by the same factor B. If this parameter beta that we measure is this, then I can rearrange all these things to combine the two things we can measure, beta, okay, and sigma 8 of the galaxies, which is just an observable. I can measure the fluctuations in the galaxies. Multiply them together, we get this degenerate combination of F and sigma 8, the fluctuations now in the mass. Okay, so that's nice, but as you can see here, it's degenerate. Okay, however, it's only degenerate if you have data at one redshift. If you have data for this combination at many different redshifts, you can actually break a lot of these degeneracies. Okay? So what I'm going to do in the last few minutes is combine measurements, all from peculiar velocities but at different redshifts, to break these degeneracies. Both these direct peculiar velocity measurements that I've discussed so far at low z with these other measurements from redshift space distortions. Okay, from Sloan, Wiggle Z, et cetera. Okay? And each one of those will give us a measurement of this. Okay? And so for a given cosmological model, this will grow as a function of z. If we're in the linear regime, it'll just scale as the linear growth rate. And this will scale as the logarithmic derivative of that. Okay? So they both give us a probe of the growth rate of structure as a function of redshift. Okay, so here's what it looks like. It's a little bit hard to see again. Here's redshift. Okay. All of these points up here are measurements from redshift space distortions. Okay, so these are all measurements of F times sigma 8, this degenerate combination. Okay, so the two black ones, for example, are the Sloan LRGs, luminous red galaxies. Okay, the blue ones are from this Wiggle Z. Sorry, I'm told we're not supposed to pronounce it Wiggle Z. It's supposed to be pronounced Wiggles, but it's spelt with a Z at the end. Wiggles is an Australian kitty, little kitty program like Teletubbies or something. So all of these data points are at high redshift. Here's some earlier ones that had larger error bars. Here's 2DF. Okay. So if we only had the higher redshift measurements, here are two different models. Here's a lambda CDM model. Okay. And here's an omega matter 1 model, which just goes through the data. Okay. If I now add to it two measurements from direct peculiar velocities at low redshift, this green spot is the supernovae that I discussed earlier. This magenta spot DNM is an independent sample of Tully-Fisher. It's basically that SFI++ sample that I have compared to a different galaxy density field with a different method. So these two points are completely independent of each other. Okay. So point number one is that this guy is clearly in favor with the lambda CDM case and not with the omega matter 1 case, which fits the high redshift data. Okay, so you can convert that into your familiar banana plots. Okay, and this is nice because we can now get a constraint on omega matter and sigma 8, the amplitude of the power spectrum, solely from peculiar velocities. Okay, if you only have the redshift space distortion stuff, it's very degenerate. As I said, you can still fit an omega matter 1 model within the 95% confidence contours. Okay, but if we use the low redshift data as well, then the contours shrink down to here. So the best fit turns out to be here. Here's the WMAP 7 point, which is within the 68% confidence limits, and that is the best fit that you would have got if you only used the high redshift, redshift space distortion methods. Okay, so what may be of more interest to people here is what happens if we abandon the standard growth picture. Okay. So I said that in lambda CDM, this F function can be parameterized by omega matter, right, as a function of Z to some power gamma. And for lambda CDM, that gamma is 0.55. Okay. For the brain world model, DGP model, the gamma turns out to be higher. Okay, so as most of you will know, you can construct a version of this model which has the same expansion history of the universe as lambda CDM, so looks the same to the supernova and to the BAOs and everything else, but it'll have different growth rate of fluctuations. So you can break that degeneracy by using the growth of the fluctuations as a function of time. Okay? And so what we're going to do in this last plot is we're going to use the CMB measurements, which are a very high redshift, to fix the value of sigma 8 at the time of the CMB, and then extrapolate both F and sigma 8, those combinations together, at lower redshifts, assuming a simple relation of this form. Okay, and obviously in more complicated models, you could have different scenarios for how those grow. That just shows you, it gives you a feeling for what the data can do for you. Okay, and so that's what's shown here. Okay, so at redshift of 1,000, the fluctuations are fixed. F is 1 at that time. The lambda CDM case, gamma of 0.55 is the magenta, and then it's 0.6, 0.65, 0.7. Okay, and again, the nice thing about the low redshift data is that the curves start to split. Okay, so you get the most handle on this parameter gamma by going to the lowest possible redshifts, right? Assuming equal error bars. Okay, and so when you do the whole fit together, you find that you get 0.6. And that actually, unfortunately, for us, it came right down in the middle between these two choices. Right, so they're both like within 2 sigma of that value. If we had not used this pink point, if we had only used our own point, then we would favor lambda CDM. Okay? If we use this one, then we favor the other one. All right. But the important point is these low redshift points give you a lot of leverage on this.
Both of those cannot be correct, would they? The green and
the green and the green and the magenta are only about 1.5 sigma different when you account for their error bars. So they're consistent with each other. Okay. So we need to get the error bars on these smaller, and we need to understand whether there's any systematic differences, because the analysis methods are actually quite different. We do a direct prediction from that integral I showed you, whereas Davis et al. Decompose the local density and velocity fields into spherical harmonics. So they're different methods.
What's our ratio?
Sorry? The CMB. Right?
Yeah, because you're getting close to the surface of one scatter.
It is the surface of that scatter.
Yeah,
it is. It is. So the CMB tells us what the fluctuations were at that time. And we know that very well.
So this is just from CMB.
No. The fact that all these curves converge comes from the CMB constraint. Okay? But then extrapolating forward into the low redshift universe, it depends on what the value of this gamma. Yes. Well, they go out to these two bins actually only go out to 0.4 is the median, right? Okay. Some of these go out deeper, but the problem is all these. If you fix at the CMB, then all these curves start to converge. So for the purposes of measuring gamma, these aren't so interesting, right? So that's pretty much my last point that I think I wanted to make. The future, there'll be better peculiar velocity surveys still coming, both at low redshift, okay? And the KSZ data will get better, especially with Planck. The nice thing about the KSZ in principle is that you can really, like I said in the beginning, with the local stuff, we can only measure the bulk flow of one volume, which is around us. With these other methods, you can actually go to different places, and you can imagine actually measuring the RMS instead of measuring one point drawn from a Gaussian distribution. So that's nice. That's a nice feature. So this will get better, and I think that there'll be renewed interest in it because of these kind of arguments, that it's really the low redshift stuff that gives you the tightest constraints. Okay. So let me wrap up there. So peculiar velocity surveys are consistent with each other at low redshift, and they give you this bulk velocity that's a little bit larger than what you expect in lambda CDM. Okay. But it's only at the 97% level. There are some hints, maybe, that some other probes are also suggesting that there are large fluctuations on large scales. Okay, so maybe there's something happening on large scales. But perhaps it's not due to the growth rate, because the evidence that we have, at least from these plots that I showed you, is that the growth rate at low redshift seems to be more or less consistent with what you would expect from lambda CDM. So that doesn't seem like the simplest explanation for it. And I will stop there. Yeah, I mean, if we in principle, yes, but in practice, I think we don't know that there's anything special about our local environment. Remember, we're not talking about like the environment of the local group. We're talking about the environment of our local 100 megaparsec sphere, right? So if we knew a priori that was over dense, for example, then in principle you might be right. But we have no evidence that our local 100 megaparsecs is an unusual 100 megaparsecs.
I mean, I guess there's no very sensitive way of telling that.
No.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the problem. The assumption is that our local 100 megaparsecs is a typical.
And then things like bias and so on are presumably adjusted to fit that.
Yeah. You're the chair.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
When and how can we expect this issue to be resolved?
Well, as we get more data, it will slowly improve. This is our survey, which has been a long time coming out, and it may not, I shouldn't have put it up there because I'm not sure when it's going to actually arise. In principle, supernovae are the way to go, but you have to be very patient, right? Because the problem with supernovae is that you only get one supernova per L-star galaxy per 100 years, and there's nothing you can do to make them go faster, right? If you want to measure a Tully-Fisher distance, you just go out and measure it, and it's done. Supernovae, you have to wait, right? And so it's going to take a... In the long, long run, much longer than the graduate student career, we will assemble a set of supernovae, which will be the ultimate survey. But until then, you know, maybe in the nearby volume that I talked about, there's sort of, let's say, 10, 20,000, a little bit more, 50,000 L-star galaxies, right? And so it's going to take a long time before they're all, well, around, order of 100 years before they all have had a supernova go off in them. You don't have to wait that long. We don't need one in every one. But it's not going to happen tomorrow. But in the long run, that'll happen. And the other interesting thing is this KSE stuff, right? So Planck will be a lot better than WMAP for this. Planck should be able to say exciting things about what's happening with clusters on large scales, at least at the level of saying whether this Kishlinsky thing is correct or not.
How much better do you think the multiple decomposition will get surveys? Is that something that's going to improve in the near term, or is that...
In principle, it should, for the same reason, it should improve, and you can do higher order multiples, and there's other things you can do as well. You don't have to expand in multipoles. So we have another paper where we just look at the correlation function of the velocities, and that gives you another constraint on intermediate scales, it turns out, is where it's most sensitive to. And it turns out that is, again, more or less consistent with what you expect from lambda CDM. So our picture that we have is that if there is anything funny happening, then it's really on the largest scales.
Other questions?
Of course, that's where dark energy takes over, right? So if gravity is doing something funny, maybe it's the largest scales where something would manifest itself. That's something for the theorists to figure out.
All right, let's thank our speaker.